Campus FM presents Talking Heads Season 3, brought to you by students of the International Master in Adult Education for Social Change.
I am Minh Ngoc Nguyen from Vietnam, your host for today. I've been involved in the NGO sector for a long while, working mostly with youth to promote critical and creative thinking for change within the community. In today's episode, we will be talking about two opposing phenomena in education, namely intellectual elitism and anti-intellectualism, and how they affect individuals and community at large. Co-hosting the show with me today is my very good friend, Milton. Welcome back to the show, Milton.
Hello, and thanks. My name is Milton Resendez Vera. I'm from Mexico, but I also lived a really long time in the United States, basically half of my life.
Thanks again for being on the show with me today. Can you help me break down the structure of today's episode for our listeners, please?
Of course. So today we'll be covering the topic of intellectual elitism and anti-intellectualism. We will start by defining the concepts, looking at them within the context of both politics and academia. We will also conclude by answering, what can we do to make knowledge more accessible, and also a little bit about the role of intellectuals in our society. To answer these questions, we will have a world-renowned intellectual in his own right, Professor Peter Mayo. He has authored over 100 papers and journals, and he has either edited or published around 22 books in topics that range from democracy and socialism, all the way to critical pedagogy and adult education. He is currently a professor in the Department of Arts, Open Communities, and Adult Education in the Faculty of Education in our very own University of Malta. He is also one of our professors in one of the subjects for the IMESC cohort. On a personal note, I find him to be a very down-to-earth man. He is very passionate on the topics he covers, but also very empathetic to us as students.
It's a pleasure to have you in the studio with
well,
us
thanks
here.
Thanks for the for the accolades. It's my pleasure to be here.
I think we have prepared quite some very interesting questions, so embrace yourself, Peter. All right, to start off, I'd like to ask you, when I first reached out to you to invite you onto the show, what was the first thing that came to your mind upon hearing about the topic today?
Intellectual work is a topic which I've been writing about because, as you know, I have worked a lot and published on the work of Antonio Gramsci. And as many of the listeners would know, Gramsci has written a lot about the role of intellectuals. So I find this a fascinating topic. I actually once entertained the idea of co-writing a book on the subject, which never came to pass. So it's a very, very interesting topic. By the way, you mentioned socialism. Actually, sociology is probably what you meant.
Sociology.
Right. I've written about socialism, but sociology is the discipline in which I've been trained, sociology of education in particular. And that's a very important theme. So I'm waiting for your questions.
Great.
All right. Well, let's jump right into it. How would you define intellectual elitism and anti-intellectualism?
Well, two extremes. Anti-intellectual elitism is, the way I understand it, intellectual activity completely cut off from the rest of the population. And, you know, it's almost like medieval monasticism inside a convent cut off, as if there was no humanistic turn within the history of intellectual life, at least in the West. And not just in the West, also in the East. Intellectual elitism is that you consider your knowledge to be superior to that of others, and that others, there's no point in actually trying to reach out to others to engage them with that kind of knowledge. That's my understanding of the term. That's how I would define that. Mm-hmm. Anti-intellectualism, unfortunately, is something that we're experiencing today, where, you know, any kind of intellectual discourse is considered to be highfalutin, is considered to be besides the point, and in an age when truth is now the major casualty, you know, we call it this the post-truth society, where the soundbite is more important than what really goes behind, you know, like what really goes into researching the issue to approximate, you never reach the truth, but approximate something which has great validity No, we go for the easy line today. You know, we can sell this to them. The whole idea is how to sell it. I think Donald Trump is an exemplar of this, but not only him. Anti-intellectualism is something I've experienced also in supposedly academic conferences, where people are much more interested in your social location than what you're saying. The moment you engage in some kind of exchange, you are shut up because you're a male, white, etc., blah, blah, blah. I remember a terrible experience I had in Granada, a conference organized by, North Americans. And I got involved in an exchange with somebody who has criticized my book. But it was a very good exchange. It is almost like we were talking about the Frankfurt School. And we were talking about how, for example, people are throwing in Frankfurt School into an emancipatory pedagogy, forgetting that there is also something we mentioned in our class today. In fact, there is what they call negative dialectics. And we explained this, that there is no solution to the dialectic of opposites. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were told that this is a very male conversation, throwing out names and concepts, etc. And I consider that to be anti-intellectualism. My fear is that this is much more, it was not just unique to that experience, but has become really widespread today. It's also become the trend today on the media.
Right. In short, would you say that you're against the expression agree to disagree?
No. I abhor any kind of anti-intellectual posturing. And, because then the opposite of that is populism. And there is different levels of populism. There could be left-wing populism, but there's very right-wing populism, which actually, as Noam Chomsky states, is an insult to the right itself. Because the right has a very strong intellectual tradition. Mm-hmm. When you think of people like Bernard Levin, people like William Buckley Jr., I mean, there is a very strong intellectual tradition. I mean, you don't just face these people easily because you really have to chew it up. And you learn a lot from them, even though you don't share their politics. And I think that is something we would have to accept. I mean, there's some really bright sparks who are on the other side of the fence, and we can learn a lot from them. But unfortunately, the opposite of that is that kind of things. That's why Chomsky says what we're having today in this kind of populism promoted by Mr. Trump and others and his ilk is actually an insult to conservatism itself, you know?
Right.
I mean, let me just give you an example. T.S. Eliot. I mean, there's a very strong conservative position, but you can't say you don't learn from T.S. Eliot, despite not sharing the same viewpoint in terms of the underlying values. I mean, there is certainly, and there's a lot of this anti-intellectualism going.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it sounds to me like both intellectual elitism and anti-intellectualism serve to kind of wall off other people from either knowledge or participation.
You see this in everything. You see this also in courses like education courses where, you know, don't bother about philosophy and sociology. Don't bother about this stuff. You know, how do you control a classroom? How do you, you know, teach this? What is the menu? What is the mix and stir recipe you use? Because that's, well, I'm sure teaching goes beyond that. But for them, what we used to call the underlying disciplines, philosophy, sociology, etc., they're considered to be too intellectual. You know what I mean? And those are the things which make you think, which make you question what you're doing. So in other words, they want us to be in the trenches without thinking about what life is in the trenches, you know?
Right, so grabbing onto that topic, where is the line between elitism and valuing professionalism or competence in certain fields?
Well, I think they're very different. I mean, we talk about competencies that has nothing to do with intellectualism. What's an intellectual? An intellectual is not as who's an intellectual? That's a $1 million question. I mean, who's an intellectual? I mean, the big definitions. One can be what you call a member of the literati group, like yourselves. I'm not saying you're not intellectuals, but, you know, you are because you're qualified, you're graduates, you occupy certain positions, etc. Or you will occupy certain positions, I hope. But that doesn't make you an intellectual. An intellectual can be somebody who has never set foot in a university, but could be organizing people at communal level, who has a vision and offers something fresh in terms of a vision, from which, therefore, critique of the present emerges. So that is an intellectual. So an intellectual, you find intellectuals everywhere. Mm-hmm. You find them amongst priests, you find them amongst one or two politicians, but it's nothing to do with the authority you have in terms of the legal bureaucratic authority you have because of you hold a piece of paper or you hold a qualification. That doesn't necessarily, you can be a graduate in philosophy, doesn't make you an intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
But you could be a shop steward in a trade union, and because you are presenting an alternative view of things, you're presenting a particular view of your world, and your action and criticism derives from that view of the world, that's intellectual activity. Now, Antonio Gramsci once said, all people are intellectuals, but not everybody has the function of an intellectual. In other words, there is the potential for intellectual work in everything we do. When we lose that, when the system becomes so repetitive and monotonous that we lose that element, then that's where intellectualism comes in. It's, you know, like you just do things without thinking about it. When it becomes second nature and you don't stop and reflect, etc.
Right. I believe Gramsci would call it organic intellectuals.
Well,
right?
Organic intellectuals is a particular term. Intellectuals are never neutral, although they may give you the impression of being so. They emerge from a particular group and they become relevant to a particular group at a particular point in time in mm-hmm. history.
Right.
What happens is, however, when the historical period changes, you can have residual elements from that group carried over into the next period. And those would be traditional intellectuals. But at one stage, they were very, very organic. They were relevant to a particular period. For example, you know, somebody who specializes in metaphysics was very relevant to the theocentric world of the Middle Ages in Europe. Okay, later, they still survive. They survived well into the 18th century, the Age of Reason. They were no longer organic. They were traditional intellectuals, but they had a certain, they hark back to a particular point in time in history where they were relevant. Now, every group, even aspiring to increase their power, will have a group of intellectuals, people who provide the thinking function and the vision for that group, who perform a role of intellectuals. They are intellectuals not in the sense of being closed in a room, surrounded by books, etc. They could do that, but they are mostly people who are organizing, fashioning ideas, helping contribute to visions, etc. So, for example, in the capitalist period, a marketing manager could be an intellectual mm-hmm. because the search of markets affects their vision of what the product should be and the way things should one should go about these things. Somebody like the late Marchionni was a very important organic intellectual for the capitalist class, the CEO of Fiat Chrysler, you know? So you have this. You have also intellectuals who go against the grain. They are basically anticipating a society to come. And the work is already being done. Think of, for example, social movements, both north and south, east and west. People who organize, people who help articulate some of the concerns of social movements, etc. They are also organic intellectuals. Organic intellectuals to certain subaltern. I mean, groups who are now not in a position of power, struggling to improve the situation. So we have a lot of people doing great work when it comes to planetary consciousness, women's movement, indigenous groups movements, you name it. Those are important organic intellectuals. In the past, you had, with the emergence of the industrial working class, you have a whole history of organic intellectuals of the working class. Many of them have passed away now, and we celebrate them as important organic intellectuals. I'm just thinking of the first industrialized countries in the world, England. When you talk about people who have been, you know, people like Robert Owen and all kinds of organizers, all kinds of people who spoke publicly. But of course, you have also two kinds of intellectuals, before, just to end mm-hmm. on this note. You have the very visible intellectuals, those who go public, mm-hmm. those who appear on television, those who speak publicly, those who write in newspapers. We call those public intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have subaltern intellectuals, which are people who are doing work in their closed space. They could be specific, like Foucault says, Michel Foucault. They could be a school teacher, could be a priest in a particular parish, but not somebody who appears on making theological points against the grain in public, or defending the status quo in public. So you have also a hierarchy within intellectuals themselves. People operating in a limited space, geographical space, people on a larger scale using the mass media, etc.
So looking into the statistics, a recent study by Georgetown University, mm-hmm. college graduates earn about $1 million more in their entire lifetimes. Do you think there is too much importance being given to these credentials?
Yes, but their purpose is not. It's beside the point of whether these are intellectuals or not, because mm-hmm. the intellectual is not how much money she or he earns. It's mm-hmm. about what does he bring into the public space of ideas, he or she. It can be done through reflecting on organization, alternative visions, visions which support the status quo affecting people's sensibilities. So you may have lots of students graduating, but one or two of them have had a profound effect on the students because they affected their sensibilities. Those are the intellectuals. So, you know, we have to dissociate the notion of intellectual from the professional. Mm-hmm. Many professions I know of are not, I wouldn't by no stretch of the imagination would I call them intellectuals. Mm. You know, they just function within the system and just repeat what other people say. And also, we have to dissociate the intellectual from the graduate. Intellectual doesn't have to be a graduate. Every society had its intellectuals well before the whole idea of universities, graduation, and certificates were created.
So the term intellectual would then be used to refer to those who engage in practice using the theories.
Practice or in the generation of ideas which captures people's imagination.
Yeah.
Trying to change practice by virtue of ideas or consolidate practice by virtue of ideas.
Right. Thank you, Peter. Because of the time constraint, I think we're going to have to go into a break now. After the break, we'll dive a little deeper into more specific context.
Yeah, we'll definitely focus it into politics.
Do you have a springboard for that? No. Right. Okay, all right.
This is Talking Eggs, Season 3, brought to you by the third cohort of the International Master in Adult Education for Social Change.
Hello, and welcome back to Campus FM's Talking Eds Season 3. If you just tuned in, our topic of the day is intellectual elitism or anti-intellectualism. My name is Milton, and I'm here with my co-host, Nock, as well as our guest for the day, Professor Peter Mayo.
Before going into the break, we talked about intellectual elitism and anti-intellectualism in politics. What do you think the context is like in academia? And also, as an academic, Peter, how do you respond to the critique that academic knowledge is so inaccessible to the population and academics can at times be snobby about it?
That's a classical accusation. Not necessarily, right? You know, it could be unfounded. Not necessarily true. Well, I'll just be brief because I know you're pressed for time. I say, you know, it's important to be simple but not simplistic. So, you know, you should write clearly. Or speak clearly without, I'm looking for the right word. Last time I used the word vulgarizing, the concept, I had a lynch mob for me. Mm. And that was in Canada. But, you know, without destroying, falsifying the concept, sometimes you can try to be so simple that you falsify the whole concept. Mm-hmm. But be simple without being simplistic is what I think there's no virtue in trying to be so obscure. Mm. And I'm also suspicious of people who are very, very obscure. Now, I know language is struggle, and sometimes things are much more complex than populists make us believe that you need a complex language, and I accept that. But I think some effort should be made at some stage to try and capture the element of complexity, however, by not making it over complex. I don't know if you understand that. So be careful, keep in mind that you need to communicate. So communication, I think, is essential. I think a good lecture is judged by the complexity of thought, but also by the way of communicating that. And at the same time, you know, like, you don't use obscurity. There are cases where I say this guy has nothing to say. He or she uses such obscure language to camouflage the fact that, you know, there's nothing being said, but he wants to appear, he or she wants to appear as saying something new. Mm-hmm. And I have an anecdote about this. A very famous sociologist, I won't say from where, had a student who's now become very famous in his field.
Right.
And there's a student who told me this, who's now a very famous professor. And he told me, you know, he writes clearly. He was pulled over by his supervisor, who is this very famous, celebrated sociologist, who told him, you're not going to make it as an academic. And this guy said, why? Do you detect any this is the guy who ended up as a professor at Cambridge, this is the language. Do you detect any intellectual limitations? And he said, no, you write clearly. That's the problem with you. If you don't write clearly, you're going to have half the readers are going to argue this point about you, and the other half is going to argue this point about him. I said, is this a joke? He said, no, I don't think he was joking. I think he was being serious. I said, well, that's the worst piece of cynicism I've ever heard. I mean, there's a lot of that going on in academia. Mm. So, as I said, try to be simple without being simplistic.
All right.
Because some things, you cannot be simplified too much because you lose the complexity and things are much more complex than one imagines.
To avoid this,
which this world right now is militating against through its anti-intellectualism.
All right. Getting into the topic of utilizing intellectual discourse and dialogue and just talking very fancy to seem to kind of control the people around you.
Highfalutin,
exactly.
As the Americans say, yes.
So some politicians try to utilize anti-intellectualism and populism to move supporters of, for example, different movements, for example, the anti-vaccination movement.
Migration, anti-migration movement.
Anti-migration, climate change deniers, exactly. What is your position in this regard that people
That's fascism. Fascism is very strong on that. There's no two ways about it. This is fascist politics. Mm-hmm. The thing is, it's not to be underestimated because it does connect with people's preoccupations, but presents things in a very, very simplistic way.
Like very direct answers.
Very direct answers when there are no direct answers to things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very dangerous. And I know who you're referring to right now. I mean, it's very obvious. This is a person who's even now also talking about black shirts, sort of paramilitaries brought in. So, you know, I mean, yes, of course, this is some people do that. And it's become the trend today.
How do we combat this manipulation of
people? This is where the work of serious public intellectuals is very important. And when I talk about serious public intellectuals, I'm not just talking about a university professor who goes public. I mean, you get an occasional journalist who does this kind of work as well. And this is where, of course, you have to combat this by showing the complexity of situations, however, without over-complexifying what you are doing, because you have to communicate to people. But mm-hmm. this is a very important issue. Now, there's a famous play. Well, it's not really famous. It's not one of the major plays by Henrik Ibsen, which deals with this issue. It raises a lot of issues there. You can say it's called The Enemy of the People. But, you know, it's not one of his best plays. In fact, the main character is basically a spokesman for Ibsen itself. That's not very good, is it, in terms of theater? But it's about individual judgment and constituted authority and how people exploit that authority to push through a project which could be detrimental to people's health. And the person who's now providing his expert knowledge is not just an intellectual in the sense he's trying to save the people by doing this. It's not all that the mayor tells you, who's his own brother, by the way, is correct. But he's doing it in such a way that, listen, you are being told false truths. In fact, that play got readapted recently. I just saw it here in Malta, which to make it fit the post-truth society. So we have to come up with very strong evidence to show nobody has the perfect truth. Nobody reaches the truth, but raise questions about certain assertions which are being made and try to approximate what gives you much more greater validity than what is being said. Because if you can show that what is being said can be knocked down, if one looks at the data, I mean, I think you have a moral responsibility to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening today is that people are getting away with murder. They have these slick lines which really fit well. Let's give you an example. Education. I'm going to present on this on the Lifelong Learning Freire and the Post-Truth Society in Toronto in April. The word thing like, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. Now, that's a wonderful line.
Much more expensive.
To get you to pay into education. But then the question is, why should education have a monetary aspect attached to it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's your classical neoliberal vision.
Yeah.
You know, like, migrants are taking your jobs, are they?
The jobs.
Who is setting up one worker against the other, be it migrant or autochthonous? I mean, these are the issues you have to look at. We have a skills crisis. Is it a skills crisis that we have? Or do we have a jobs crisis? We have a system which is going through crisis, and the plural, yes, and we're presenting this as, rather than the system's inability to provide jobs, and we present this as a lack on the people's part. We call this a skills crisis. You don't have the jobs. Meanwhile, people continue learning and relearning, and they don't get the jobs to which they are aspiring. Why? What are the reasons? So you bring out the reasons. Explosion of the job market, therefore over-credentialing, puts down the price, etc. Massive, massive, massive migration from China, flooding the labor market, which puts down the price of labor. So these are the issues that this is where you need serious research. But it's important also that when you do serious research, you have control on the manner in which that research then is put into the public domain.
Mm-hmm. How it's interpreted.
Rather than allow a journalist to pick up your research and create a report, because that's what people read. People don't read the research thing, they read the article. A journalist can twist that around.
Yeah.
You know, he can twist that. May, not necessarily deliberately, you know. So it's important that we also write articles presenting the findings of our research in such a way that we challenge the populist discourse out there about that specific issue.
Right.
And this is very important, for example, with regard to climate change, as you said, certainly migration, etc. Just look at, you know, like the celebration of Thomas Malthus, you know, the whole issue of Malthus. I mean, Marx and Engels, to mention two people who are not fashionable today, debunked his theories on the grounds that they were not rigorous and empirical. They were all armchair conclusions.
As a very briefly closing like remark, what do you think is the role of intellectuals in our society today?
The role of intellectuals, I think they should have the moral responsibility, and I'm not sure I've done a lot in this regard myself, to make themselves heard, to speak truth to power. This takes us back to the fool in King Lear, speaking truth to power and be prepared to suffer the consequences of it.
Thank you, Peter. That was very powerful. And thanks again for being with us on the show today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thanks to you, our audience, for tuning in. We hope you learned as much as we did.
All right. And remember, if you are interested in finding out more about the International Master in Adult Education for Social Change, also known as IMASC, please go to www.gla.ac.uk. And also, to follow the journey of the third cohort, that's us, of IMASC, visit our blog at IMASC, that is IMAESC, hyphen, unmasked, UNMASKED, dot squarespace.com.
And that's it for this week. Please tune in the coming weeks to follow us as we engage in dialogues about various topics ranging from online education and technology, migration, human rights, activism, and many more. Thank you, Milton, for hosting with me today, and Zach, our co-producer.
All right, well, thank you, Nat, for having me on, and thank you, audience. Muchas gracias, Peter.
De nada.